You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Looking to buy your dream home? Or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
On behalf of this week's sponsor, I wanted to tell you about the amazing work that Deliveroo and the Trussell Trust have been doing together to support people facing hardships across the UK. To date, Deliveroo and its customers have helped provide over 2 million meals to people through the app and their Roundup and Donate feature, as well as helping to fund vital wraparound services provided by food banks. Deliveroo have also pledged to increase this number to 4 million meals globally. Any Deliveroo customer anywhere in the UK can add their support, and it's so easy to do too. You simply choose to round up your order to the nearest pound when you place it on the app on the checkout page. If every customer who used Deliveroo, and there are millions every month, rounded up just 10p on one order, the impact would be enormous. Times are hard right now, and a lot of people are struggling to afford the essentials, leading to food banks needing to support more people than ever before. So this provision of meals really is crucial to so many people. The money also goes to supporting the food banks with financial support in the form of advice on debts and benefits, as well as connections, which will hopefully end the need for food banks and lift people out of poverty long term. A small donation in this very simple way really can make a huge difference. If you can, consider rounding up your next order on Deliveroo. You can give as little or as much as you like. Find out more at DeliverooFullLife.com. I'll pop the link in the show notes. Thank you very much to Deliveroo. Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 desert island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. The question is, what would you choose as your last meal? Hi, I hope you're all very well. A lovely episode for you today with the brilliant Tom Bateman, who I'm sure lots of you will already know, but his story is really inspiring. His road to success hasn't been completely smooth, and he's very open and honest about it, which is actually quite rare, but I think so important. It's so easy to look at where someone is now and just not really see the big picture of how they got there and the ups and the downs and everything that goes on behind the scenes. Tom is one of those people who I can honestly say truly deserves all of his success. There are people out there doing very well who, you know what, just actually aren't very nice behind the scenes. And I actually find that thoroughly depressing. So it means when good things happen to nice people, it makes me very happy. And Tom is definitely one of those people. Thank you so much to everyone who signed up to the new newsletter, Dinner Tonight. There are now over 7,500 of you in just a few weeks, which is amazing and so exciting. Thank you so much. The newsletter is a new venture for me. It's one delicious, easy weeknight recipe sent to you every Sunday. If you choose to be a paying subscriber, you get it every week. And if not, it's every fortnight. I get a lot of messages from people who listen to the podcast, and often they very kindly ask if there's a way to support what I'm doing. And as of yet, there has never been. So the newsletter is about the recipes, of course, but it's also a way to show support for the podcast, etc. Being reliant on brands and algorithms, it's honestly quite draining. So the idea of people paying less than £1 a week for the newsletter, I mean, that would just honestly be a dream come true, as I love bringing the podcast to you every week, and genuinely, your contribution to the newsletter really does make a huge difference. So thank you very much. Anyway, on to today's episode with the brilliant Tom. I do hope you enjoy. So my guest today is Tom Bateman. Tom started his career as a chef at the age of 17 after training at Buxton College and gaining a knowledge of the classical techniques. He quickly rose through the ranks, becoming head chef at the tender age of 18. In 2009, Tom decided to leave the culinary world behind him in order to protect his mental health and get a change in scene and a chance to travel the world, to learn more about the world, but also himself. 10 years later, Tom started a food blog known as Bbox Food, which reignited a passion for cooking. And through this, he began working with big brands. And before long, he'd amassed a large and loyal following online. That following now sits at close to 3.5 million followers. Heading back to his roots, Tom decided to open The Flintlock, his critically acclaimed restaurant. It's a family affair, and it's from here he creates all his recipes and videos. He's appeared on the Great British Menu, where he was invited to compete to represent Staffordshire. With all this success, and yet it seems like Tom's only just getting started. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Tom, it's been said of you that Tom's cheerful demeanour and unpretentious approach to his craft are a tonic to an industry which has often appeared bombastic and overblown. Do you think that has been the secret to your success?
I mean, it's always nice to read a quote from your own mother.
Oh.
No, I'm joking. I mean, whoever did say that, or where it came from, that's incredibly kind. I mean, I guess that's kind of the thing. I don't really set out to be anything specific, just the way I am, I guess. And if that's how it lands, then I must be doing something right somewhere.
And what do you think about, particularly the fine dining world, what is it that is so often represented as bombastic and overblown? Why do you think it tends to attract that kind of person?
I mean, what I would say initially is those sort of preconceptions are slowly but surely starting to disappear, I think. And there's a lot more accessible fine dining, I guess, is a way of putting that. I don't know, maybe it just comes from a sort of a price point thing that was always a special occasion, or you could only go to somewhere that was, you know, inverted commas, fine dining if you're willing to spend loads and loads of money. I think that, again, is something that's changed, becomes more and more affordable, despite, you know, everyone's got the financial burdens at the moment. But I just think it's an opening world. And those sort of preconceptions of snooty fine dining, I think, are slowly but surely making their way out of the world. I mean, there'll always be a place for like really high-end sort of luxurious vibe, but I think there's a lot more accessible stuff, right?
Definitely. It's just interesting to see the types of personality that are drawn to certain areas of food. And I think it's like the same conversation that often happens about how women are often like the home cooks or seen to be, and then it's the men who are the fine dining experts. And it's something, as you say, like it's slowly changing. And it's just interesting to think about, I think.
Yeah, for sure. All those sort of dynamics are changing. I guess, you know, if there was a figure of a fine dining chef, you know, it's probably a guy in his 40s or 50s with a big tall white hat. And that's just not the world we live in, right? It's just...
Tom, I'm very disappointed to see today you haven't come in your big tall white hat.
Yeah, no, I had a random fact about this the other day that supposedly 100 folds in a chef's hat that represent 100 methods or recipes of how to cook an egg.
Wow. Didn't know that. No, yeah. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I think from looking at everything you put out online, at the centre of it all is a message that good food should be accessible and most importantly, delicious. And nostalgia plays a huge part in your cooking. So let's talk about the first desert island dish. And that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
Okay, so for me, the one thing that stands out for me is, can you remember the cod and butter sauce in the little packs?
Ooh, yes.
I think you sort of poached them within its packet, or I don't really know. It was just delivered to me in a rectangular, fishy, buttery piece of joy. I really love that with probably some form of potato and some peas and... it's something that I actually recreated recently for a demonstration, which was nice. But yeah, that for me is the one thing that I would always go back as a memory.
Was food a big part of your family life when you were growing up?
Yeah, for sure. Mum, who actually works at the restaurant, not in the kitchen, but she's a wonderful cook and she still is. And yeah, so it was always part of what we did. It categorically a pillar of my life from an early age to where we are now.
And food is so powerful. And I think the food of our childhood can really play an important part in future life. Nostalgia, as I've said, is a common theme in your cooking. But talk to me a little bit about that. Why is it so important to you?
I think it's powerful. I think memory is so powerful, especially with things that transport you immediately. I think with food, you get that sort of, because it's sensory, it just sort of can immediately transport you to a place of joy, hopefully.
Yeah.
I think that's why it's so important to me. And I just feel like I draw my strongest inspiration from memory, really.
Mm. You went to Buxton College to train as a chef. Presumably, I'm thinking this was around the age of 15. Was cooking all you ever wanted to do?
I was a little bit older than that, actually. Feels like a long time ago. I'd started to work at the restaurant I was at, and I did it sort of... part-time or within the working framework of what I was doing.
Okay.
So I was 17 and I went there for 2 years, I think, which was great, to be fair, because it gave me a sort of fundamental grounding of what it is to be in a kitchen and that respect of classical technique and all that kind of stuff. So, it was really good.
When you were growing up, was that just always a really obvious career path for you, that you would go into the world of food, or did you think about doing anything else?
I think it was what I always felt I should be doing. Mm-hmm. Whether it was what I wanted to do long term was up for debate, because, you know, when you're a teenager, you think that, yeah, I suppose 20 years ago as well, that you couldn't go out every single night, especially where I lived. So your weekends were gone, and it was the commitment to doing that which put me off. But then I was just overcome with, this is what you should be doing. So I set sail with it and managed 6 years before I crumbled and decided it wasn't for me.
But when you say you felt like it was what you should be doing, where was that coming from?
I think it's just within me. It's just what I love to do. Mm. And like, I get questions like, oh, do you just go home and not eat, or do you get fed up with cooking or whatever? And it's just like never the case. Like, days off, I spend filming nowadays, but I'll always find myself in a position where I want to make food and feed people. You know, holiday, if I can cook, I'll cook. I don't want to just sit around and do nothing. That's just not me. So I think it's just there all the time, and that's what I want to do. I get the most enjoyment out of doing it. So.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing that you found something that you love that much?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, it has its flip sides, but yes, yeah, it is. It's true. And I get to do it every day now.
You got your first cooking job at the Mexican restaurant Castros at the age of 17, an experience that you describe as being like a baptism of fajita-led fire. Was working in the restaurant, or any restaurant, what you expected it to be like?
I think from what you see on TV and stuff, that it was what I expected. The physical demands I underestimated for sure, because like, I think this is something that is talked about, but maybe not enough, that the demands on someone working in a kitchen are physical, mental and emotional.
Mm.
I think that this is something as an industry we are improving for sure. Like, we're reducing the number of hours that people work and stuff. But 20 years ago, there's just an expectation to never stop. I never had a day off for 2 years. Like, it's crazy when you think of it. You know, we had an opportunity to go on holiday once, 1 week in a year, which you say that out loud now and you just thought, no, well, why would you do that? And it's just how it was, I guess.
Because now they're saying, I think, so like back in the day, it was everyone was doing doubles, like back to back all the time. Mm. And now I think that isn't even really allowed anymore, I don't think.
Mm. And quite rightly, even the restaurant, we're looking to condense the days we're open because we don't want the standard to suffer, but we also want the staff to be ultimately fit and healthy and well. So
Yeah. That's
the best way for us to do it, is to condense it rather than sort of expect people to work day after day.
And so you were really thrown into the head chef role at the age of 18, which is quite unusual, I think. Presumably you were managing a line of chefs who were older than you and possibly more experienced, I'm imagining. Like, being a head chef is so different to just being a chef. What was that like?
You learn quickly, for sure. There was three of us and I was the youngest by quite a way. You just learn on the job. And I suppose we still learn on the job every day. If you're not learning, then you're standing still, etc. But it was a very interesting period because I'd never done it before, obviously, and to be in that scenario in a busy environment, learning as I went, trying to scratch around and work out what to do next. It was tough, but then if I hadn't done it, I probably wouldn't be sat here now.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Okay, let's talk about the second Desert Island dish, and that's the first dish that you learnt to cook.
So this is random, really random, but it was a giant bourbon biscuit, or bourbon biscuit, right? I think that's right. It was in a Gary Rhodes book, Great British Classics type book, and there was a TV series that went with it, and I think he made it on the TV series, I'm not sure. But he'd got three, like, really large versions of like, biscuits that we would recognise, and that was one of them. And I thought, I'm going to make that. So, yeah, that was the first thing I ever really learned to make.
Well, how old do you think you were?
11 or 12, I think, something like that.
I think it's so often the way, and it obviously makes a lot of sense, that as a child, like, pastry is the gateway to cooking, isn't it? Like, it's always something delicious and cakey or biscuity that draws you in, and then that's where you can really get the cooking bug, I think.
Yeah, a gateway to an addiction, for sure. But yeah, like you say, it's just like you associate that the sort of sweet stuff with fun as well, I guess. So if you're a young person, that might be your gateway. But think carefully, kids.
You might end up with your very own restaurant if you're not
careful.
Yeah,
you never know.
So you did 6 years in the restaurant before things came to a head and you ultimately decided to walk away from cooking. You've talked openly about that time and the struggles that you had with your mental health, which I think is so important that these conversations are happening more and more, and particularly men, mm-hmm. I think, because there isn't very much dialogue around that. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened that brought you to make that decision?
Yeah, it was obviously a very tough period and something that you quite rightly point out needs to be more open in conversation, for sure. It's the best and only way through it. So I suppressed it for a while and it just ended up as a mess. It's just too overwhelming for a young person in that position. And I just couldn't get away from it. I wasn't getting paid very much, which, you know, was the industry then. Another thing that's on the rise, which is good to to know. But the walls were closing in on me because I had no free time, I had no money. I was disillusioned with what we were doing because we weren't making food that I want to make. At 23 at that point, or 22 or whatever it was, I was ready to be a real chef rather than, you know, use spice mix from the shop and pre-booked fudge cakes. It just wasn't real to me. It was just all the bad things about hospitality with none of the good.
Yeah.
So, and all that cycled up into a position where I just had no option. And it's like, I've got to leave the industry. There's nowhere else to go. So it's time for a change. And that's why and where we got to. And yeah, it was really, really tough. Fortunately for me, I had a way out in terms of another job to move to within the family business, which was just like relief. Yeah, I went to do an admin job, sales admin job, and it felt like a completely different world because, you know, I got to work at 8:30, left at 5:30
yeah.
and could do what I wanted and was getting paid a reasonable amount of money.
Yeah. A totally different ball game.
Mm-hmm.
Something that occurred to me when I was reading about your story is that I think it's important to remember that whatever you're doing, whether it's cooking or, you know, you might love what you do, but it isn't who you are. It's part of it, of course, but it's not the entire story. And I wondered, when you made that change, did you feel any sort of sense of identity crisis in a way, stepping away from everything that you knew?
For sure, yeah, because we were... And at that point, the restaurant I worked at, Castro's, was its own little world. Yeah, it was me, my older brother, a couple more staff. We were our own community because we socialised together because you couldn't do anything else on those days off. Or, you know, I used to go to the cinema on my own, which I do now for out of choice.
Yeah, that's but, different.
It was out of necessity then because I had nothing else to do. But... So, yeah, to then go into a world that was normal, more normal, if you like, was very, very different. And even things like, because I worked in the kitchen from 17, obviously, I was under a lot of pressure. I had no patience. So I started to go fishing because I needed to teach myself patience, and in my view. And just to be able to do something like that, something more normal that other normal people could do and I couldn't, was very liberating for sure.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of being able to just do nothing on a weekend, like it just seems so, so different and a completely different environment to what I was used to and had been used to from essentially a teenager, like, you know, leaving school to a young adult. And yeah, the whole world changed in that moment.
Yeah. Like you describe, it's almost being on a hamster wheel that you just can't get off, and there just isn't time to even think about anything beyond the immediate, you know, what's happening. And like you say, having the space to just do something for yourself, like fishing, that's it's so important. Let's pause there and talk about the third desert island dish, and that's the best dish you've ever eaten.
Now, this is a tough one because there was one that stood out for years and years, and I just didn't think it'd be bettered, which was, these are both desserts, randomly.
Okay.
I'm not, you know, I love a dessert, but I would probably err on the side of savoury, given the choice. First one, which stood out for years on end, was a dish I ate at Tommy Banks' restaurant, the Black Swan. It was a Douglas fir and caramelised white chocolate dessert, and it was mind-blowingly good. To me, at that point, I think it was 6 years ago, and I was, like, not back into food at that point. So we went there because I'd seen him on Great British Menu, and it was where we were living nearby. And I was like, I've got to go and eat there. So we did, and it blew my mind. And that particularly, I was just like, I've never had anything like this before, you know, like foraged ingredient turned into a dessert like that. It just blew my mind. And it was the best dish I'd ever had until recently.
Dun, dun, dun.
Until it was certainly joined on the top spot by my now good friend Tom Shepherd's Banana Man dish from Great British Menu.
Ooh.
It was just, at that point, I mean, I was incredibly frustrated because I was in competition against said dish, but it was so brilliantly executed and well thought out, as well as being delicious to the point of I can't even understand how you've done this.
What? So what was it?
So a banana creme pat mousse, which had got like popping candy in, and he'd set that in the shape of a banana and dipped it into chocolate cocoa butter to form the shape of the banana, so it looked like a banana. Then on the side there was a banana cake, which he'd soaked in banana rum. And then a banana ice cream with a banana caramel. I mean, and if you don't like banana, probably not for you. He served it on a little glass bowl with banana leaves inside, and it had like a little dry ice with a banana aroma going round. And then he went backstage and dressed as Banana Man. So there was even an element of comedy to it. Ah, this guy's too good for me.
No, not too good for you, but that's the last thing you want to come up against when you're in a competition, isn't it?
Just... Yeah, I was doing all right until that point. It's like, oh, no.
Yeah, unless you've got some kind of fancy dress costume just in the boot of your car, there's not much you can do at that point.
Yeah, it did me on that. But yeah, it's just incredible. Those two, if you put me on the spot, they're the two that really, and yeah. Both by people called Tom as well.
Yeah, there's a theme. I think that's interesting that you say you're not a sweet person and yet those are two sweet options. We haven't had many puddings chosen for this answer, I think, which is interesting.
Maybe it's the thing is with desserts, they can be so, so unique, whereas like savoury food can not be samey. That completely is the wrong way of describing it, but they go down a track of like, you know, beef. People are familiar with beef, or unless you get something that's truly unique, that might be why. I think that's probably why they stand out, because I've eaten such incredible food all over the world, really. But those are the things that stand out because I've never eaten anything like those things.
Ever. Yeah. I think also it might be with the savoury dishes, when people talk about the best dish, it's often the occasion or who they were with, or it's a specific memory. But I think you're right that in terms of puddings, because they can be so unique and like special just in themselves, it's less attached to a memory and it's more just this amazing experience of this pudding.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I was with my wife, Sally, and the first one. So that was definitely contributing factor.
Sally, if you're listening, that was definitely why it was one of my best.
Yeah, it was absolutely because of you, Sally. Nothing to do with the dessert.
So you would spend the next 10 to 11 years working in the family agricultural engineering business, which you say gave you the freedom to travel and explore different countries and also find out more about yourself. Do you think that traveling is a really important part of self-discovery?
I do, and I don't necessarily mean, to go on a plane particularly. I think I learned so much from driving around the UK and seeing different approaches. And I think because the business that I worked in sold to farmers, so you see a very, very much on the line every day their livelihood and what it means to them and the isolation and all that. And so the characters you meet and the opinions that you hear and just the idea of seeing that up front, and obviously you're dealing with livestock as well, so you there's that impact. And I think seeing those places from the far reaches of Scotland right down into Cornwall, I think was really eye-opening. And then to go further afield it almost felt like a bonus to me.
And also in terms of the food and your passion for that, did you find that your culinary world expanded through travelling?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, the food interest never went away. So wherever I was going, if I was going to Scotland, chances are I was looking out some, you know, haggis as a basic example. But like I'd just find the best places I could go and eat. Probably probably frowned upon by the person signing off my
expenses.
Just a
Michelin star here.
Yeah, nice hotel and restaurant again. Yeah.
You were lucky it was a family business, Tom.
Yeah, I still hear about it now. So, But then, like, that was my opportunity. Even if I was paying it for it myself, why would you not, if you were in my position, I guess, if you wanted to learn more about the food and the reasons why people made what they made, which is just as important, then take the opportunity while you're there.
Definitely. And you were to be reunited with your love of cooking formally in 2019 when you started taking pictures of the food that you were making at home, and it started garnering recognition across the internet. Your food caught so much attention that you were awarded the 2022 Social Media Influencer of the Year. Were you surprised at your online success? Oh, wow, you've got the mug to prove it. That's gorgeous. Is that what you got? You got a mug as a trophy?
Yeah, that was my trophy. Golden Staff Canteen mug, which I treasure, obviously.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Yeah, it's all a bit bonkers, really. I remember the specific conversation, and we were talking about somebody else's life and career. We were actually skiing and Austria and Saalbach, but we were chatting to a good friend of mine, Jason, and his wife, Tamsin, about his sort of future ambitions and what he wanted to do with his career and stuff. But then I suddenly thought, well, what am I doing with myself? You know, is this really what I want to do? And I loved my job and still love the business. But deep down, I knew it wasn't sort of fully scratching the itch of what I wanted to do. So that's when I thought, right, well, I'll set something up as a little side project, with no intention of it actually going anywhere, really, just for my own enjoyment. And at that point, we were living in North Yorkshire, but I was commuting down to the family business, which is in Cheddleton, right next to the restaurant. And I was staying with my mum in the week, because I'd sold my house to move up to Yorkshire. So I needed somewhere to stay in the week. Mum still lived in Stoke, so I stayed there. And so I'd got 3-4 nights a week potentially to fill time with. So I was like, right, well, this is what I'll do. And I started making various things, just taking photos, taught myself food photography. And it's like, well, we might as well make it look good. So it then was a good dish that looked good and was posted in a form where people could see it, and it got some big attention, which was, I was like, oh, well, this is good. So you see success, you repeat it, right? That's kind of the thing. So I just built on that, and after 14 months, I'd got 10,000 Instagram followers, which was mental. Mm. I was just like, how is it? We even got a balloon for it. what happened here? And then, yeah, well, it's got significantly bigger since then.
Yeah, like 10,000 is worthy of a balloon, but what on earth did you do for 3.5 million? A hot air balloon?
We've not really had any kind of celebration. I did say to the kitchen team here, if I got a million TikTok followers, we'd go out, and we've not been yet.
Oh,
and
Tom!
2.5 million. So we need to go and do something for that, for sure.
Yeah.
We talk a good game. It's now time to implement the day out.
Obviously, it's all very exciting, but is it one of those things where actually that first 10,000, it's exciting, and then you're obviously always wanting it to grow, but you can never quite capture that feeling of that first wave?
It was the biggest celebration I've had internally about it, for sure, because it felt like something. It felt like I'd achieved what I'd set out to do, which was to gain recognition for what I was doing,
yeah.
I guess. So, yeah, that was the big... The million on TikTok was... The first million was also inwardly quite a celebration.
Sorry, Tom, but the phrase "the first million" is really... That's quite cool.
Yeah. Quite cool. It's mental. Like, I can't really... It's so frantic, and it starts to gain more and more traction, and you're just like, I'm not really sure why this is happening, but keep doing what you're doing type of thing. It seems to, people seem to like it, and I like doing it because it's a complete change of pace from what I do normally. So it is enjoyable. It's like having another full-time job,
but yeah,
because I do everything myself.
That's incredible. We're going to pause there and talk about the most important question of the day. Tom, what is your favourite sandwich?
I think it'd have to be a steak sandwich. But now there's criteria there. It's got to be good steak, obviously. I mean, that seems to go without saying. But I like Taleggio cheese on there. That's what I'm going to say. Yeah. I also like to toast the bread, which has to be ciabatta, I'd say. Mm. Yeah, I reckon. A good one, obviously. In the steak pan juices, you've got to threaten it with a bit of greenery as well, because life's all about balance.
Yeah, health.
A little bit of rocket, yeah. A bit of rocket, potentially a watercress. And maybe some caramelised onions, and you're not far off. Truffle mayonnaise if you're feeling especially fancy.
Tom.
But it's not truffle oil, because that is horrible stuff. But you can get this truffle mustard that does the job. Yeah.
Well, that's a good tip.
It's one of them things as well. Like, it's such an easy thing to put together. Not potentially that sandwich I've just described, but like, if you get home and you've got the equipment, it can be done in seconds. And you can... I really like a sandwich that you take that little bit of extra time over. Turn it from something that was, you know, functional into a masterpiece.
Yeah.
I think that's what a real sandwich is all about.
Yes, it is. It's taking the ordinary to the sublime, and that's what we should be aiming for with our sandwiches. So at the time you started doing your videos, I feel like there weren't many actual professional chefs showing how to make simple dishes. The traction was enormous, as we've said, right from the beginning. And with this huge audience, there comes a lot of power. Did you feel that that changed how other people in the industry began to think of you?
Definitely. Because when I first set about it, I wasn't a real chef, in theory. I was doing it at home. And that is an important point, that a lot of people who you see online are not actual chefs, or they don't work in a kitchen currently, because most people who do wouldn't have time to do it. So they are two different things, and like, that's totally fine. Doesn't mean that they can't show you amazing food. You don't need to work in a kitchen currently to do that. But like, where you'll feel the benefit is how you can use it more practically, I guess. So that's my excuse anyway. That's my thing.
Did you feel like other chefs, they hadn't heard of you before, or I don't know, you've then developed this like level of kudos, and did you feel that that kind of changed things?
Yeah, you've got to sort of prove yourself. Like, that's kind of, that's true of any industry, and especially one like this. And I think there was things along the way that really sort of said, actually, you know, I can do what you do. You just don't know that yet. Obviously GBM was a big one, because to cook in such an elite competition and do reasonably well was a big marker in the sand for me. It's like, well, yeah, you see, don't just make videos.
Yeah. So that was obviously GBM is Great British Menu. Tell us, like, how did that come about?
So I was in a tiny, tiny hotel room in London, which they tend to be, but this one was especially small. And I'd been, I can't remember where I'd been to, an event, I think. And I was hungover and it was hot. And I just got an email through saying, would you be interested in being on Great British Menu? You've been recommended by someone. And I was just like, what's going on? Yes, I would absolutely like that opportunity. So then you go through the interview process, and I just, all the way along, I just thought, well, I can't, no, they don't want me, surely. They must have plenty of other options for this region. And yeah, sure as anything, about a week later, I got the call to say, you're on it. And I was stood outside filming a video. I was like, right, stop this. go and do your real job. So yeah, and then it all sort of snowballs from there, and it's a very lengthy and serious process, as it should be, and yeah.
How long are we talking?
So I found out I was going to be on in the first few days of August, and then we didn't film until November. But you have to submit your menus at the same time as everybody else, so it's a level playing field and fair.
Oh, okay.
So I had a couple of weeks to do that, and then you can make sort of little changes along the way, but nothing wholesale because, you know, you've committed to that. And then you've got to source all your own props and practice, which I didn't really get the opportunity to do. So we had some difficulties with staff, all the big build-up, and then you turn up and it's fully legit. As you see it on the screen is how it is. No one knows who anybody else is. It's all a complete surprise. You don't know who your veteran is. And then, the whole whirlwind of the show begins and you've just got to cling on for dear life and make sure you get through to the other end of it, which I did, fortunately.
And how did it feel like? The element of being on TV, did that come naturally to you? Did you feel pure excitement, or were you, it must have been hugely nerve-wracking? And also you were representing, you know, your restaurant, and was there an element of feeling like you had something to lose or something to prove?
All of that. Fortunately, I don't suffer with nerves. The only time I get nervous is when I watch football randomly.
Oh, but, really?
It's, so I've got that under control, but the weight of expectation was huge because I was like, you've got yourself in this position. If you mess this up now, everything that you've built up in terms of gaining respect from your peers or the chefs, other people in the industry, you know, putting the proof behind the fact that you can really do it. If you get kicked out straight away, what does that say about you in the restaurant, because people know that you are in the restaurant all
God,
the time.
So stressful.
Yeah. And then shove 8 cameras in your face and doing very long days under strain. And Paul Ainsworth staring at you for hours on end. It was quite pressured. But then on the flip side of that, it really engaged my brain of like, right, nothing gets through that you're not happy with. And there's obviously a time pressure and there was things I was disappointed with. But if I left knowing that they were my fault, and I'd give everything I could to make it as good as I could. I left nothing behind, and to come up short against Tom Shepherd, who was a banquet champion, with his main course and arguably should have been with his desserts, best dish I've ever eaten, was gratifying. You know?
Yeah, that's kind of the best case scenario, isn't it? You want to, if you go out, you want to go out to the person who then ultimately wins.
Yeah, because you were knocked out by a champion. That's totally acceptable.
Totally.
From someone who's only been cooking at this level for, at that point, 2 years. So yeah. I was willing to take that.
Let's pause there and talk about the fifth desert island dish. What's the dish you eat the most often?
Probably, given, you know, chef life and restaurant owner life to put on top of that, time is not my friend. So I get in and I have a small child to deal with and everything else. So when I get in late, I need something that I can turn around quickly. So I really love to make like chili oil noodles.
Ooh.
And with like fried egg, I can turn it around in minutes and it's like absolutely delicious. So I'd probably say I eat that 3-4 times a week potentially.
Oh, do you?
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone has their own slight version of that dish. What, talk us through yours.
So depending on what I've got available, I tend to buy like random bits of, chili stuff and Asian inspired ingredients. So I've almost always got a selection of chilies and garlic and ginger. And then we get like a little bit of sugar in there, a bit of salt, and get some lots of garlic, to be fair. Like, I must stink, to be fair. But,
there's just no such thing as too much garlic, I don't
know. No, I don't think there is. And my wife would probably argue with me. I just stink of garlic. No, it's because I've eaten a lot of garlic. definitely a bit of sesame in there as well, soy. And yeah, get that all together. Like a bit of paprika in there. I don't think that's really legit, but it makes it nice and red. So yeah, that's my blend. Nice bit of hot oil over those noodles. And what, I'm not fussy about noodles. I just love noodles. So like whether the thin ones, the biang bang or whatever, I'm into it. It's a thing.
So good. In 2020, just before the first lockdown happened, that was when you got the keys to your new restaurant, the Flintlock at Cheddleton, which, talk about full circle, because that's actually the same restaurant or the same premises that you started out at age 17. That timing must have been incredibly difficult. Talk about a roller coaster, like the excitement of opening your own place and then suddenly the world locking down. Tell us a little bit about what that was like.
It wasn't ideal, but what I suppose at that point, I didn't know what was going to happen. So I was just like, well, we don't know how long this is going to potentially last for in terms of like the impact on the working world, etc. So we'll set sail with it and see where we get to. Then a couple of weeks later, it was like, right, don't go anywhere. I then spent, I guess it was 3 or 4 months before you were allowed to travel at home in North Yorkshire with my daughter, who was only 6 months old at that point. So, like, if there was a positive to be out, that was it. Obviously, my wife was there as well. So we got that time, which we would never have got other than the scenario we all found ourselves in. So from there, it was a case of, right, I can now travel again. So I'm going to come and decorate the restaurant because it needs gutting and reshaping. But unfortunately, I have nowhere to stay because my mum was isolating. So, and so was my dad. So I've got no one I can stay, because you can't stay with a friend. So I've got nowhere to stay. What am I going to do? Okay, I'll just go sleep on the floor. So I came and slept 3 or 4 nights a week, every week, to get this underway, and actually a few yards away from where I'm sat now. So, you know, we'll get the occasional flashback. And sleeping in a restaurant building is not like sleeping in a house. It makes a lot of noise and stuff. So, but that was all part of the process. And then there was a literal blood, sweat and tears that went into it all. And I had months to do it. So I just cracked on and suffered without a shower for a few days every week because I knew what the goal was. Like, there was an inner desire to get it done and no one was going to stop me. And I didn't care if I'd slept on the floor for months that this was going to happen. So that's what we did.
Yeah, that's amazing. And when you were eventually allowed to open, I think you had a 7-week period before another lockdown hit. You say during that 7 weeks, you made a lot of mistakes, which obviously, of course, because every new place makes mistakes. But what were some of those mistakes? And is there anything, if you were to do it again, you would do differently?
I'd do it all differently if I did it again.
Would you?
I think, yeah, because I was cooking for people I wasn't making what I wanted to make. It's as simple as that. We were trying to do things to suit everyone's taste, and until I had a conversation with Paul Foster recently when I was thinking about switching to Tasty Menu, I didn't really understand what I was doing until that conversation. And he said to me, you have to realise that you've not opened a restaurant because people need a place to eat. You've opened it because you want to do what you want to do. So if you're not doing that, then you're doing something wrong. So there's loads of places to eat around here. There's a town two or three miles in either direction with loads of food. So he's absolutely spot on. There's 2 pubs within 2-minute walk. So we were trying to really be everything to everyone, and it was just a bit of a shambles by my own admission. And I harbour all that responsibility because it's ultimately up to me what we serve. So we learned a lot. I was tearing my hair out reading every review, and some of which weren't that pleasant and quite right. And it was very, very important, that little period. And again, we felt some benefit of having to shut. It was obviously a massive financial burden, but the idea that we got to stop and reset was critical. And I don't know whether we'd be where we are now if that hadn't have happened.
It's so weird to think about that time and actually think that there were positives to it. It's like you got a test run almost, and then you got time to digest what had happened and then tweak it. And as you say, that I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it was a real steep learning curve because I'd never done this before, of course. This was like my first solo venture. Everyone was looking at me for the answers. And to the point where I was so not with what I should have been doing. My focus was so all over the place. I was even printing menus before the start of service. Like, why am I doing that? Like, you'd look at it now and just think, what were you thinking? Why weren't you making the food better? But that's just, you learn all this stuff.
But Tom, within 10 months, you'd got two rosettes, hadn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was, again, one of those sort of landmark points of I can do this. It felt like a huge, huge relief. When I found out, I don't really use Twitter, but I found out via the medium of Twitter, I was actually at Chester Zoo with Isabel, my daughter, and she was just in the pushchair. I want an ice cream. Yeah, hang on. What's this? Oh, I've got two rosettes. And then it just dawned, I'd have just started crying.
Did you? Like,
just floods of tears. And she's like, what are you crying for? Can I have an ice cream? Like, yes, yes, you can have ice cream.
Have all the ice creams you want.
Yeah. Just go and empty the freezer. But yeah, so I was just like, oh, this is happening now. We're underway type thing. And that, like, it was a huge, huge success for this business and what it is and what it was and where we've come from and the lack of experience particularly that I've got and all the team have got. But to get that was huge. But then within a few hours I was like, okay, good start. What do we do now? And that's how it's been ever since. We can't stop unless we get to where we want to be.
It's a journey. We're going to talk about the sixth desert island dish. What's your go-to dinner party dish?
So I really like doing the simple things well when I'm out of the restaurant. So all week long, I'm making super refined, tasty menu dishes. So when it comes to hosting people outside of that environment, it needs to be big, bold and comforting, whether that's sort of like a roast potentially or something along that track. I really love barbecue, like I'm a massive fire nut, so anything on a barbecue would be great, you know, that big pulled pork or a brisket or something like that. That's my dinner party vibe. It's like, you know, don't expect tweezers and fine dining. You'd like, go to the restaurant for that.
Come to the restaurant and you can pay and you can eat that kind of food. Do you throw many dinner parties?
No, not really, because I'm always here.
I was going to say, do you find people are a bit intimidated to ask you round to theirs?
Oh, yeah, massively, which should be the opposite way around. I think you'll find that most chefs, cooks or whatever will always be really, really grateful.
Yeah.
The only time they'll be critical is if they're paying for it, because then they earn the right to say what they think.
Yeah.
But if you invite me around to your house, I'm going to be the most grateful guest you get because I'm not cooking.
Yeah. Do you normally serve a pudding?
Yeah, definitely. Like that's another giant bourbon biscuit. I love doing a pudding, like a proper one. Mum's really, really good on the pud, so like it's usually a tussle with who's gonna do what. I mean, it must be a dream for a guest, you know.
Yeah.
Got the two of us fighting over who's making your pudding, and you might end up with two.
I mean, yeah, so, that does sound like the dream. So, what kind of things are you making?
So, like, she's like on a lemon meringue or a pavlova, that's her vibe. She's good on anything like that. I'm more down the track of, like, I love making ice creams because, like, I'm just into that. So you're likely to get an ice cream from me at some point. But I like, sticky toffee pudding. Like, can't really go wrong with that, can you? And, like, a bit of Pedro Jimenez in the old caramel. It's just, that is about as staple as it gets for me for a dinner party. sticky toffee pudding with just that little bit of Pedro in the butterscotch or caramel with the vanilla ice cream.
Or what about a sticky toffee pudding with the Pedro in the ice cream with some raisins?
Oh, what? Oh, we could soak the raisins in the Pedro. Yeah.
Honestly, like, Tom. Okay, that needs to happen.
That's going on the menu.
On Desert Island Dishes, we've got a cookbook corner. What is your most treasured cookbook?
Funnily enough, it's propping up my laptop so I can actually see it. I have many, like most people who do what I do, but The Complete Rebuchon is like my Bible of, like, if I need to know how to do something classical or get to the fundamental roots of a sauce, for example, then that's where I'm going. Or there's the LaRousse one, but that, like, it's quite heavy going as a read, whereas this one's more of a normal book.
What? How many cookbooks do you think you have?
I've got 10 in front of me. I've probably got, I don't know, upwards of 50 probably. I'm lucky because I know loads of people who are releasing books, so they just send them to me, which is very nice of them.
Yeah.
I really like Tommy Banks's book just because it's just my kind of thing. Yeah, Nathan Atlow's books are great as well.
Tom, we're on to the final 7th desert island dish. What is the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island?
Like, I really love a duck liver pate parfait. Like, I'm really into that, like with some brioche and a chutney of some sort. So if I'm multi-coursing, that's gonna be my starter. It'd have to be like a massive steak. Like, I'd really love a steak and triple cooked chips, like done properly.
Yeah.
With maybe béarnaise. Like, béarnaise for me is like the don of all steak sauces.
Like, why is it so delicious? And why do they give you an option? Like, would you like peppercorn or béarnaise? Obviously, I'd like béarnaise.
Yeah, I like béarnaise because I'm an adult. As long as it's not like, you know, straight out of the fridge, I can't do with that. Someone gave me, I don't know where it was, but a steak with béarnaise, and it was like fridge cold. This is not what I was looking for today.
Of all days, why today?
But yeah, so lovely big piece of steak with maybe chuck an onion ring on there. Like, you know, it's delicious points in it at this stage rather than calories. So, like, yeah, well. And then what am I going to have for a pudding? I suppose I've got to take Banana Man, right? That's got to be it.
Yes. So,
and take Tom with me to then facilitate more Banana Man whilst I was there.
That sounds perfect. Tom, those are your desert island dishes. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
So there we have it, another delicious day of Desert Island Dishes. Don't forget that you can rate, review and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. It really does make such a difference. I know everyone always says that, but doing those things does something to the charts, and then it tells other people that this is a good show that they should listen to. So it really does make a difference. If you don't already, then come and follow me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes, and you can sign up for the newsletter Dinner Tonight at www.dinnertonight.substack.com. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you next week. Bye.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V20 6-Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Stop by your nearest Lowe's store and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.